things happen to people who listen to radio.
Once we understand the bug, we will defeat it.
Are you ready for
radio? The only good bug is a dead bug.
Shoot a nuke down a bug hole, you got a lot of dead bugs. All right?
Some say that a live and let live policy is preferable to war with the bugs.
I say kill them all.
Yeah.
Put it on and leave it on.
Welcome to Bug Radio, boys and girls. Is the Chinese Communist Party trying to chat us up? Some people think so. What do they want? What are they like? We'll find out. We're talking beer hats, perspex, and should we have locked down 2 weeks earlier? Or is the Pope a Rastafarian? We're all up on Threads Radio, that's threadsradio.com, and you can follow us on @BugRadio2020 on Twitter and Instagram. Give us a click. To thrash it out, as always, I'm joined by the Woolworth Whirlwind, Mr. Kieran Monks Kaufman. Pissing it down, isn't it?
It's pretty miserable in England for our international listeners. Raining every day.
That's right.
There was a brief break in the rain yesterday when I went to play tennis with some people, but because people aren't allowed to play football yet, although some people do, there's now enormous pressure on the tennis courts. So there was a backlog of about 30 sets of would-be tennis players, and it was getting quite shirty. And then there was one dude who was playing shirtless with a back-to-front baseball hat, which is very annoying.
Yeah.
And he was just playing with his person for hours and hours. And there was this huge queue and everyone was getting like more and more shirty. And by tennis standards, that was about as much friction as I've seen. And it got a bit ugly, but it was sort of kept within bounds. So clearly, yeah, people still experiencing lockdown related tensions. What's new with you? Heard you've been for a jaunt slightly further afield.
Yeah, I went because my cousin's got a car. So we went to Cliff Marshes, which is this amazing wildlife reserve, on Sunday. And then yesterday I got cabin fever, so I just masked up, got on the train to Canterbury and just wandered around there for a bit. Didn't go anywhere near anybody. And we've got plans. Me and my cousin are going to go on Friday. We're going to jump in the car and go to Dungeness, which should look quite epic in the rain and the sort of grey sky and stuff.
Home of the Dungeness crab.
That's right.
We can't be expected to hold ourselves to a higher standard since Cummings.
No, well, I mean, we can. I mean, you know, we don't want to stoop to his level, but, you know, I just got bored and I thought, fuck it.
Speaking of fuck it, excitingly, the racial equality campaigns have evolved into a new exciting phase of knocking down heinous figures from history.
Right.
So we've seen Colston go in the drink. We've seen Columbus in Richmond taking a swim. Leopold II, a monster comparable to Hitler.
Yeah, even Andrew Neil got on board with that one.
Robert Milligan in West India docks, another slave trader removed from his plinth.
Not everybody's happy about it, though. The senior Tory councillor in Bristol has described slave trader Edward Colston as a hero and the toppling of his statue as frenzied thug violence. This is Councillor Richard Eddy. I'm horrified and appalled by the rank lawlessness which was exposed in Bristol on Sunday when the famous statue of Edward Colston was attacked and vandalised by a criminal mob. In 2001, Councillor Eddy resigned as deputy leader of the Conservative group at City Hall after he began to use a gollywog doll as a mascot. And then he got into further hot water soon after that when he said the council should hire more attractive lesbians. There's actually a rather touching picture of him here with his gollywog doll. So there we are. And I think a fair few of these Conservative councillors with slightly questionable views are probably going to start crawling out the woodwork over the next few days, I would imagine.
Yes. And there was some lame equivocating people saying, oh, sure, slavery's bad, but why did they have to knock him over?
Yeah.
Sadly, although it wasn't the totality of his remarks, you could possibly say that Keir Starmer's reaction was along those lines. But particularly in the case of Colston, apparently the statue had this protection as heritage, and so all the efforts from the Bristol mayor and the Labour council were coming to nothing.
Yeah.
So it was either he came down that way or not at all.
I don't believe for one second that Keir Starmer personally thought that those people were wrong to take the statue down. But there's quite a lot of people on Twitter who are making the point, which I think is true, that if he had openly sided with the people who took it down, what he would have done was basically allow Priti Patel to turn it into a law and order issue, Whereas what he did, he just puts that shit take at the beginning, which is, I don't think they should have taken it down in that way. And that gives him a hearing with 60 or 70% of the public for the other 90% of what he said on the subject, which was about empire. So by doing that, he's kept the discussion about empire and stopped the Tories from dragging the row onto their turf.
I suspect the first part will stick with him, that people won't forget that opening line where he said they were wrong to take him down in that way. And as I mentioned, there wasn't another way of taking him down because all the regular channels had been thwarted. And that hypocrisy was also highlighted when Daily Mail people were getting upset that Colston was knocked over in such a undignified fashion. But then they also got pissed off when Robert Milligan was removed by the council with proper order. So clearly the problem for them is not having all the slave traders with prominence. So I think that mewling can be disregarded.
Yeah, the thing that really boils my piss is the people who say, look, it's in the past, you know, just get over it. I mean, white people are obsessed with Find My Family Tree websites. There's loads of my family who've spent hours and hours like digging up their family tree. Millions of us watched Danny Dyer discover that he was apparently related to Edward III, I think it is, on Who Do You Think You Are?
I think I'm going to treat myself to a raff.
What, the...
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be a good look for you.
Just get a massive ruff, just bowl about with it, and, you know, if anyone questions it, and then I'll explain to them why I'm wearing a ruff.
And one of the hallmarks, actually, of the far right is this infantile idea that they're kind of descended from the soil in some way. I mean, white people love delving into their background, so it shouldn't be that much of a stretch to empathise with somebody who delves into their family history and digs up something a bit shit. You know, I mean, I try not to get angry on this show, but you know, it's not rocket science, is it? Just fucking grow up.
This is also going to inflame some of the culture war tensions that have never dormant for long these days. So you had Tommy Robinson from wherever he is in hiding now, mm-hmm. getting riled up and ordering his goon squad to go and defend Winston Churchill, who I don't actually think is about to get torn down, but he's riling up his goon squad, people in the Football Lads Alliance, so umbrella wanker organizations apparently coming from all over the country. And Hope Not Hate, the anti-racism group, put out a warning saying that we should expect an influx of meatheads to the Capitol this weekend so that they can sort of drink tins and sing about German bombers and feel on the right side of history. I don't know if they, well, just sort of try and sort of have a fight with some people of other heritage. So, yeah, conflict seems very likely as well, because, you know, while there are caricatures with that position, there's also a lot of liberals who, on sort of free speech grounds, say we've got to have monsters on every plinth, or at least you can't get rid of them without erasing history, which seems like nonsense, because as a lot of people have pointed out, we've learned so much more about history for people like Colston getting chucked in the river, and suddenly, you know, everybody's in a dialogue about this, and nobody knew anything about him really beyond Bristol, where I think everyone did know a lot about him because he was sort of rubbed in everyone's faces all the time.
Yeah, like if you don't have statues of people, then you won't know anything about them, which is why nobody knows anything about Hitler. You know, no one's ever heard of Hitler.
Right. So this is going to continue, and statues are going to become this sort of huge set piece within our never-ending culture war, and get prepared to hear a lot of annoying perspectives from platforms other than Bug Radio. So around January, early February, China.
Let's say China.
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 China. China.
Was well set for pariah status. All the stories were about feckless incompetence in allowing a virus to be released through the already notorious types of markets where exotic animals such as pangolins are traded, or even worse, that they were sort of bioengineering something to destroy us all.
Germ warfare.
Yeah, suppressing heroic whistleblowing doctors, barbaric practices, draconian oppression. But in the great tradition of Instagram influencers, they are channeling all that negative energy into something positive and have somehow parlayed this situation into a position of strength. And we're going to talk a bit about how they're managing to sort of emerge from this whole crisis of their own making strengthened. And a lot of that is to do with their messaging, which is very multifaceted. So, for instance, as American cities have been in flames over the past weeks, the Chinese have positioned themselves, or the Chinese state has positioned itself as an ally of African Americans. So this was a take in a state outlet a couple of days ago. Quote, "The cultural genes of white supremacy are imprinted on all levels in the United States, and minorities such as Africans are firmly nailed in education, employment, and social welfare." The phrase, "I can't breathe," that Floyd shouted before dying, screamed out the common aspirations of American minorities struggling under the haze of racial prejudice and discrimination. And by that same token, when a US State Department spokesperson put out a tweet challenging China's move to exert more control over Hong Kong, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson shot back, "I can't breathe." And that achieved a lot of traction, engagement.
Did you see that some Chinese readers responded to the Chinese foreign ministry head tweeting, "I can't breathe," by tweeting, "I can't tweet," which is...
which is quite good. And given the Chinese treatment of the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, many other...
It's a bit rich, isn't it?
Yeah, it rings hollow. But this is just one part of how their messaging is being quite, at least superficially, effective, because they're playing on a really sore American weakness at this point. You know, their sort of sordid history of racial oppression and fucking over minorities. At this point where American wounds are laid bare, the Chinese government are in a position to rub their noses in it. And to a lot of uninitiated people who I suppose won't be familiar with the tightly controlled facts of Chinese subjugation of a lot of people in their society, you know, that suddenly just looks like a bunch of zingers. And then they've used their soft power quite effectively as well in terms of supplies, because as so many countries around the world have been desperately short of essential protective equipment such as masks and ventilators, the Chinese, who had managed to really stockpile early in the crisis by being first hit, obviously, they were then in a position where every other country was dependent on them. So, for instance, a little while ago, Italy's ambassador to the EU, Maurizio Massari, was saying that he got no support from other European countries. Unfortunately, not a single European country responded to our call. Only China responded. This is not a good sign of a European solidarity. And then one last point on this for now. When Chinese charities sent 300,000 masks to Belgium, the state news agency was able to get a photo opportunity of the masks arriving draped in the slogan, "Unity makes strength." So clearly making a play for, you know, the kind of unifying leadership role so conspicuously vacated by the Americans.
The Chinese foreign ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian told a news conference this week that double standards were typical of the US. Many people may want to ask this question: why does the US refer to those Hong Kong independents and black-clad rioters as heroes and fighters, but label its people protesting against racial discrimination as thugs? I mean, it is kind of a fair point, no? Is it one all there?
I think they've realized that the American leadership has so abandoned any standards or even any pretense of standards that even sort of shameless, hypocritical posturing still looks better than Donald Trump yelling at a 75-year-old who's got, like, beaten up by the police. And so they're really trying to take the high road. And we saw that open letter from 100 Chinese scholars to the American population. So bypassing the American political establishment, which is clearly just sort of gibbering in a corner somewhere and doesn't know what day of the week it is. And so it's just saying the sort of sensible adult things. So countries should be working together, not complaining, finger-pointing and blaming one another. The virus does not know borders, but neither does love or friendship. As two of the great countries, cooperation between China and the US can bring a more positive outcome for all of humankind. So I don't put a lot of store in the Chinese government's claims to lofty humanist values. But the fact that they can even string a sentence together puts them greatly in advance of the American regime.
I mean, we've talked before on this show about how the Chinese Politburo will want to seize any opportunity to export its peculiar brand of politics around the world, and I guess the bug is no different in that sense. According to the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, China's development is peaceful in nature, and it will not harm or threaten anyone. China does not seek hegemony now, nor will it do so in the future. Now, we at Bug Radio are, of course, paragons of editorial responsibility, and we wouldn't want to unnecessarily scare anyone. But the reality on the ground isn't entirely consistent with these claims. So for one thing, China has become the world's largest lender, and it's increasingly seeking to control global trade and the ownership of commodities. It's buying up maritime linkages and shipping infrastructure like ports. It's building hundreds of airports and railways throughout the world under the One Belt, One Road initiative. So it's certainly trying to build economic power. And as far as America First goes, this is a zero-sum game largely. But perhaps more worrying are the military tensions between America and China, which are not new. So the row over strategic control of uninhabitable islands in the South China Sea has been toxic for some time. According to an interesting book called Signals by Pippa Malmgren, Chinese submarines are constantly popping up and surprising US Navy patrols. And the fishermen who man Chinese trawlers regularly wear People's Liberation Army grey, and they carry surveillance equipment on board their boats. And in 2015, America and China had to sign an official memorandum of understanding which forbade Chinese and American military pilots from making obscene hand gestures at each other, which gives you some idea of how close these guys can get to each other in midair. So the so-called new Cold War has in many ways been bubbling away for about 10 or 15 years now. And as we've discussed, it's becoming increasingly difficult to pick a side, although I do absolutely agree with you that simply the ability to not look like a clown does play well for them.
Well, the ability to not just be continuously soiling yourself in public.
That's right.
To speak better of their faculties. But listeners shouldn't worry about perhaps expansionist ideas from China, because a new interparliamentary alliance on China has been formed, which will be in Britain co-chaired by Ian Duncan Smith. So presumably they are
to the rescue.
Presumably they are absolutely shitting themselves at this in China. Ian Duncan Smith says they're taking the piss.
He's quite a scary looking guy. He looks a bit like Nosferatu.
I mean, well, fuck, you know, no doubt he prefers picking on disabled people rather than nascent superpowers, but maybe he thinks he can have a pop here as well. So he says that we're going to stand against their abuses of human rights, coming from a guy who presumably wants a monopoly on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And their sort of unfavorable trade policies, which he probably cares about a bit more because, you know, they give our government a bit more of a headache. And then the Chinese have hit back immediately, calling this outdated Cold War thinking, which it almost certainly is. But it takes two to tango.
Yeah. Have you seen this Twitter propaganda machine?
Yeah, that was interesting. I suppose it's in line with a wider social media strategy that also takes in a Chinese-owned creation, TikTok, which has suddenly become very popular, conveniently, during the plague. I mean, I'm sure David Icke would have something to say about that. On Twitter, the suggestion is Chinese state departments are able to hack and subvert popular Twitter users' profiles. So in some cases, they can take outspoken American activists' profiles and just from them, just sort of start spouting anti-Hong Kong screeds and regime platitudes. And what's interesting about the TikTok approach, beyond its wild success all over the world, it seems, is how they've split it into two strands. One for people outside of China, where it's very soft focus and getting influencers and beautiful people to talk about universal values and how much China wants to help everyone. And then a far sterner tone for people inside of China, where it talks about how critics are ungrateful wretches who need to shut up, and there's all these corrupt capitalist pigs who don't know anything, and some fairly audacious claims, one of which leapt out at me, saying that 92% of coronavirus patients in China have been cured by a traditional Chinese medicine discovered 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, if that were true, should they not have offered us some before now?
Yeah. I mean, this whole farmed Twitter activity, this is happening all over the world, isn't it? I mean, the Russians were the first people who started to gain a reputation for this.
Yeah, well, this is why when somebody on Twitter points out glaring inaccuracies in my articles or says, you know, this episode of Bug Radio was full of falsehoods, I'm quick to dismiss them as a regime troll.
There's a really interesting book which everybody should read called This Is Not Propaganda by Peter Pomerantsev, which goes into this in some detail. The main reason I don't get into arguments with people on Twitter, and actually why I don't use Twitter to try to gauge the political environment more generally, is that it's just becoming increasingly difficult to tell who or what is actually real.
Yes. There's so much deniability as well. I mean, the Chinese propaganda farms could easily be outsourced to some company that outsources it to somebody else. So it's a perfect crime that you don't need to leave fingerprints on, but nonetheless is getting the message out there very effectively. This sort of maintenance of message discipline is occasionally challenged by growing dissent within China.
Yeah.
Chinese web users are restricted by censors in various ways.
Yeah.
One of the most egregious misdeeds in the early days of the outbreak in China, we gather, was this huge state-led effort to suppress whistleblowing from Wuhan doctor Ai Fen, who said that there was human-to-human transmission and blew a hole in the official story about how this wasn't really anything to worry about. And so there's a huge effort to censor him. But in a bid to fool censors, AI software, Chinese web users translated an interview with him into five languages and dozens of formats. So the text was rendered backwards in emojis, Braille, Morse code, song sheets, and even the Elvish language from The Lord of the Rings. And in the story about this, experts are saying that this sort of pushback and ingenuity is unprecedented and suggests that people are mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. That, you know, the suppression of free speech in China is becoming more difficult to maintain.
Yeah.
And while they may be winning the information war to some degree against the Americans now, partly because the Americans are so determined to come across as
insane,
as badly as possible, that there's a few icebergs lurking in the water for them too.
Yeah. I've often wondered how long it would be before some sort of Politburo proof proxy server starts to become popular among Chinese students and the dam truly breaks. There was an interesting diary entry by Long Ling in the London Review of Books in January, which described an exam that the author took to get into the Chinese Politburo. And it so explains sort of what you need to do and the way that you need to behave and the sorts of answers you need to instinctively come up with in order to be a Chinese politician. And it described an explosion at an industrial park in Yangcheng, which killed about 80 people. And it's amazing how similar the Beijing response to that was. Just dismiss it as a rumor, smear the whistleblowers as troublemakers. I mean, privately, I think a lot of Chinese people are probably developing some trust issues with central government, and it will be interesting to see if that turns into anything concrete in the near future.
Now, more than ever, we need
radio. Commence blathering.
There's been a whole hoo-ha about how bad the messaging's been.
We think it's important to stay sane.
Radio.
When the fuck is this going to end?
Just trying to find something properly weird.
We need to find whatever it takes to get through this rotten fucking plague.
Right, Britain. Our green and pleasant land is likely to suffer the worst coronavirus damage in the world, says the OECD.
Yeah.
A slump in GDP of 11.5%, which is worse than, well, everywhere, but even places that we thought were, you know, almost as bad or worse than us, such as Italy, Brazil, America. And this is despite us also having, we believe, the second highest death toll in the world of currently more than 60,000.
Yeah.
So the worst economic damage and the worst death toll. Why are we so shit?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have thought there's a single Bug Radio listener who doesn't have a fairly extensive and expletive-ridden reason of their own why that's the case. But I mean, as things stand, we look like we've lost on both counts, don't we? We've got the worst death rate in Europe and the worst economic contraction, whereas other countries like, for example, New Zealand, look like they've handled it the best.
Yeah, New Zealand says that it has no cases, zero cases. They didn't flatten the curve. They smashed holy hell out of it. Jacinda Ardern, slay queen, as they say online. Hmm. She slayed the bug. The bug may return, but for now, New Zealand is golden.
Yeah, I mean, she's just been incredible. It's a quite interesting approach to patriotism. She called it our team of 5 million people. Like, she calls them the team as a way to kind of get everyone to pull together. Just to play the devil's advocate for a second, it looks like the kind of Cummings 4D chess approach as regards herd immunity was that, at least in theory, the countries which locked down the hardest and earliest would post fantastic numbers in the short term, like we've seen in New Zealand. But come November, this coming winter, no one would have herd immunity there. So they'd have to ignominiously lock down again, knowing that they'd have to keep doing that, basically, until a vaccine appeared, which certain more fatalistic experts are saying could be ending up to 10 years. Whereas the clever, plucky Brits this winter, who'd put their pensioners on the block right away, would be off their tits in the pub with £50 notes fluttering out of every orifice. I mean, are we absolutely sure on Bug Radio that that theory is dead? Could we consign that to Room 101?
No, it is too soon. I suppose the get on with it doctrine will not be fully discredited until any country can be confident that there won't be another massive resurgence. So while the picture is bleak in the UK, they can take some cold comfort from the possibility that it might still get a lot worse somewhere else. Some quite explosive remarks coming out of top epidemiologist and
disgraced bee activist Shagger.
Yeah, ladies man, bug supremo, Professor Neil Ferguson, who's just come out, presumably a propos of almost nothing, I guess, having just sort of emerged from another orgy.
Well, bear in mind, it must have been quite awkward for him sitting on the sofa watching the Cummings debacle, mustn't it? I mean, he must have been absolutely fuming.
Right, yeah, just sort of throwing dildos at the TV. The epidemic was doubling every 3 to 4 days before lockdown interventions were introduced, says Ferguson. So had we introduced lockdown measures a week earlier, we would have then reduced the final death toll by at least half. He's getting a fair amount of support from people that believe we locked down too late, which I think is probably most people at that point. Is that you as well? Should we have locked down earlier?
Well, it absolutely was me. Just before my work sent everyone home, I couldn't understand why the government hadn't already locked down and also just done it completely unannounced as well. Just wherever you are, you're staying there. Because at that point, we just had that problem in Italy where the plans for the lockdown were leaked. And hundreds of thousands, if not millions, I think, of people just jumped the quarantine out of Lombardy and basically spread the virus all over Italy. I mean, if that hadn't happened, that definitely would have squashed their numbers.
Although this should be caveated, I believe that the government has been getting some pretty average advice. That's my impression throughout, that the CMO and the experts that were advising our feckless government were advising them not to lock down so early. And it's also my understanding that, for instance, they told the mayor that it was okay for people to still be using public transport up until a point where that was already off the table in a lot of other European countries.
Yeah.
So I think while Ferguson may have a point, I think his sort of field haven't covered themselves in glory here. I mean, I think there's been a lot of average advice, a lot of contradictory advice. And it doesn't necessarily do any of them, especially the disgraced ones, all that much credit to try to do a told you so now.
Have you also noticed that all of the medical stooges, I mean, I've given up, I haven't watched any of these daily briefings.
They're not as good anymore.
Yeah, for a while, because I just want to try to avoid smashing the telly, basically. But most of the famous medical stooges like Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance, they're nowhere to be seen. They've just left the stage. I don't think anyone's heard a peep out of either of them for about 3 weeks. Who was it who went on Kay Burley? Was that minister? What's her name? Yeah, Helen Wakely went on Kay Burley and tried to stick it to the scientists and then had a good going over by the Kay Burley flamethrower. So you get the sense that there is a legal shitstorm brewing, basically, and the government are going to try to blame the scientists for what happened. So Chris Whitty and Sir Patrick Vallance, I would imagine, are probably in their bunkers lawyering up to the back teeth, no?
It was conspicuous. Yes, I think their most go-to gurus, Whitty and Vallance, weren't prepared to go and tell the country that Cummings hadn't broken the rules.
Yeah.
So they belatedly discovered a backbone and some sense of self-respect.
Mm.
So now, presumably, they're sort of wearing a cement overcoat in the Thames somewhere.
That's right.
Or they're just no longer useful.
Do you think if they were the new David Kellys, I mean, that would really add a...
It would show that their meek servility and a sacrifice of all dignity in the early weeks was for naught. And I think there's a lesson in there for the nation's youth. And I just want to add that Piers Morgan famously claimed that no government ministers had been on his show to justify their policies and strategy for, I think it was 23 days. And it's presumably been ongoing ever since. Well, no top line government ministers have come on Bug Radio for now almost 9 weeks. What have you got to hide? Time to clear the air, tell the truth. Bug
Radio. Put it on and leave it on.
So we might be overtaken by events here because we understand that there will be an announcement suggesting some further loosening of restrictions. So we may be able to see more people than before. We're hearing rumors that restrictions will be loosened again to allow more sociability. So we'll keep an ear on that.
They're basically hoping that we get so fucked that we just forget to criticize them.
That probably would work. So increasingly, life is returning, but not as we knew it.
Mm.
The suggestion was that pubs with gardens might be allowed to operate them from June 22, now pushed back to July 4.
Independence Day, lest we forget.
Right. And now there's this sticking point of 2 meters versus 1 meter, because the Danish pubs, which are being allowed to operate, say that that makes all the difference. So Hans Henrik Agger of Carl's Gastropub in Copenhagen said, if we had to open with 2 meters, it would be difficult to make a profitable business. We would have to reduce our seating by 70%.
Mm-hmm.
With only 40 or 50 guests, it would have been impossible to make a business of it. And the WHO guidance, so far as I understand it, is 1 meter.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't quite know where we've got the 2 meters from, but it seems that that is life or death to pubs.
Yeah, the thing is, he's talking about an indoor environment, is that right?
Yes.
You're right. So if you're going to cut the distance of 1 meter in an indoor environment, it starts to become a bit more important that people wear masks. And it's quite difficult, I've found, to down a pint through a mask. So are we going to see special beer masks with straws that come up from your pint? Are we going to see bespoke, tailored COVID-19 beer hats, you know, that kind of hard hat that had 2 pints attached to the top and straws that went into your mouth so that you didn't have to pick up your pint? Could we start to see those become kind of standard issue?
Famously modelled by Jeff Daniels in the hit comedy Dumb and Dumber.
That's right.
I suppose he is now vindicated. That could easily become the new common sense.
Do you think maybe he'll get royalties if they start getting rolled out internationally?
I think it would certainly give the movie a new lease of life, and it's already a sort of sleeper hit. Although I don't really see why. It's not as good as Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, for instance.
Yeah, it's a shit film, isn't it? Dumb, let's not beat around.
Yeah, but we talked about how masks have been this area of dynamic innovation.
Yeah.
So I'm sure we will see plenty more of that. But given that the 2 meter rule doesn't really survive contact with reality, so everybody says that you've got to practice it, but the way cities work that have huge clusters of people in parks, on roads, everywhere.
Yeah.
It just means it's not really possible. And it's going to be that much more difficult in a pub environment where everyone is pissed and emotional and watching football and just not able to maintain that stiff upper lip approach to distance that people seem to be expecting. So I suspect it's just going to have to be a kind of take a chance approach.
Let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, give the bug an opportunity, and it's the honor system.
Yeah.
And then another area of life, there's an interesting bit by Jonathan Nunn in The Guardian suggesting that as restaurants begin to reopen, they might want to not completely get back to what they were doing before, because during the lockdown, there's been some quite heartening developments. So some restaurants have repurposed to cook for homeless people and NHS staff, or sort of remodeled their supply chains to work with local produce, and have sort of turned themselves into places that are open to all on pay what you can principles. And so, you know, do we want all the best eateries to go back to being extremely exclusive and unaffordable? So perhaps that's an area where we could see some lasting positive change.
There's also been this initiative where when restaurants open, I think it's July, isn't it, or something, they're going to have Perspex screens in between the tables. Is that right?
That's a suggestion.
Yeah, to be honest, I fucking hate it when they sardine you in right next to a bunch of other complete wankers just to make themselves a fortune. I say long live Perspex screens, you know, all us and our friends, and we get to hear each other talk rather than trying to shout over other shouty people and shit music. You know, I'd be perfectly happy to see that stay the same, no? Actually, to be honest, I've never been in a restaurant which has got those screens. It might maybe make the thing feel a bit more clinical. It might kind of destroy the vibe. I can kind of see that side of it as well, but you know.
I don't mind eavesdropping on conversations of strangers in restaurants if they sound good, if they're loose-lipped.
No, that's fine, but trying to shout over somebody who's shouting.
Yeah, I mean, I think segmenting could be exciting for a bit.
Yeah, I like restaurants that have got like little booths, you know, that are sort of labyrinthine and they've got little kind of nooks and crannies and everything. I much prefer that to just having a great big Munich beer hall thing. Although I guess that can be good as well, I don't know.
Yeah, I think maybe for pubs we want more of the Munich beer hall, but especially with the social phobia that will now no doubt be increasing many more people, that as so many people are not used to seeing anyone,
yeah,
it would be a lot to just suddenly plunge us all back in together,
yeah,
from the bug perspective, but also from the psychological perspective, that you can't go from 0 to 1,000 in no time at all. And it will cause a lot of anxiety and probably accidents as people drop their linguine in sheer terror at the presence of other people in their personal space.
I think there's probably going to be quite a few people who were particularly paranoid all the way throughout the lockdown who might be permanently scarred by this and very possibly won't enthusiastically wander into large numbers of people ever again.
Right. And so public facing businesses should make an effort to try to accommodate that tendency, because I can think of a lot of very sociable, gregarious types who do feel more inhibited for this. And I think that's probably a rational change. I mean, I think probably teenagers can't wait to get out there and spring break again. They could barely contain themselves during the peak of the plague. But I think for a lot of other people, it's going to take time, if at all, to get back to that level of comfort and security amid crowds and in public places.
Well, that's it. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to call us pricks, you can do that on Twitter at BugRadio2020. And if 250 characters isn't sufficient for you to express your contempt, you can email us on BugRadio2020@gmail.com. We'll be back next week. Now wash your hands and piss off.